Brother Fry, you mentioned that you lived the time when with other brethren, that era. Could you explain to me or tell me something about Brother Russell? Did you ever see him? You mentioned that you spoke with him. Do you remember what the conversation was about? Is it something you could talk about?
Well, I think I did tell you this story before.
I don't recall it.
But it'll bear repeating. I don't mind repeating it. Well, of course, Brother Russell gave the New York Ecclesia, as he called them, and that was with the friends that lived in the Bronx. They lived in Brooklyn, in Queens, in Manhattan, on Staten Island. Some lived in Jersey City, some lived in Newark, all nearby places. They had all come over to the temple the first
temple.
Sunday in the month. It was the Creation Temple, you see. And they'd always come over to hear him, and the place was crowded. All the balconies were full, you see.
Wow.
So I was interested in just what Brother Russell would do with one of these people that came to hear him talk and said how much they enjoyed his ministry. I wanted to see what he would say about it. So I managed to get myself up into the foyer, and he'd be there before I was, because he'd go behind the wings and downstairs and up the stairs in the front, and he would be there before I could even get through the crowd. And then I would see him there shaking hands, and there would be a sister. She'd take a hold of him. Oh, she says, "Pastor Russell, that's the best sermon I ever heard. Oh, I enjoyed it so very much." Well, I was anxious to see what he would say to her. He says, "Sister, are you consecrated?" He wasn't too much interested in whether you were pleased with his sermon, but he knew if you were consecrated, it would mean a lot more than if you weren't, see. And he always felt how nice it would be if through his ministry more people would come in. It would mean the sooner he would reach his glorification with the other members of the church, you see. So, in other words, you see, he had in mind one thing, and this he preached. This was the essence of his life, consecration and dedication to the Lord's will, you see. So, as I say, this was one instance. And, of course, the other one, I think I told you that probably on the way up. I don't know whether you were there when I told the story. One day there was one of these indigent men, a beggar. He stood outside of 122 Columbia Heights. That's Bethel, see, or Bethel. And so Brother Russell asked him, "What do you want?" He says, "Oh, if I could just get a cup of coffee and a little bite to eat, I would be so happy." So Brother Russell says, "Well, come right in here with me. We'll take care of you." And so he brought him in, told the friends there, put him at a table, gave him some coffee and some stuff there. And as is common with Brother Russell, he would give a talk, see, a table talk. And of course, this fellow was there eating his breakfast. And Brother Russell, after he finished, says to him, "Did you understand what I said?" The man shook his head and said, "No, not a word of it." And one brother there, he was a foreigner, spoken English, he says to Brother Russell, "Brother Russell, I think if you let me, I can explain to him. I know just what he wants to know." So Brother Russell says, "You go right ahead." Brother Russell says the man spoke. He says, "I don't know when I have ever heard anything less coherent than what that man said. But I asked the little beggar whether he understood." He says, "Every word of it." So Brother Russell says, "Well, you see, it's not merely the truth itself, but it's the level on which it reaches the hearts and the minds of people. You can't always go by being able to give the best, the noblest, the most accurate expression to the truth. sometimes it has to be on the level of the mind that is in trying to conceive this thing.
Was it that the man couldn't understand English, or was it that
well,
it was too
he probably could concept. Understand English, and Brother Russell's English was very plain indeed. But you see, even at that, for a man that had been around in the gutter and probably begging for food, and he probably didn't have too much of an education. He might have been able to work or do something, you see. But the fact that he wasn't able to get anything, to me, would be an indication that he was probably somebody whose mind wasn't quite as good as it might be. So I noticed that Brother Russell in one of the Tower articles says almost that very same thing. Oh, but you see, I'm great for gathering together anything that he said that I might use. And that's the reason that there's so many extra little sheets in my notes upstairs, because I'll put something in there and I'll say, for instance, I've written one article on the fig tree. And also I've written another, I've started it, but I haven't finished it, on the olive tree, see. But I draw on Brother Russell, see. Not only on Brother Russell, but also I draw on others, you know, that may be talking on the same subject. Now, I've never noticed, as Brother Russell laid any particular stress, he's spoken of it, on the fact that Paul, when he's speaking to one of the churches in the early days of the Gospel Age, it's Romans, actually, is where he says it, in the 11th chapter of Romans. He speaks of the olive tree, and he speaks to the Gentiles, who are the wild olive branches, and they have been grafted in to the good olive. Now, anybody who's had any experience with a good olive tree knows that you cannot graft a wild olive into a good olive tree. It's contrary to nature. And in fact, the Arabs have an expression for it. It says the wild olive conquers the good olive. To me, that should be the good olive has conquered the wild olive. But that's a matter of understanding. But at any rate, this man by the name of Thompson, T-H-O-M-S-O-N. He was a missionary in Palestine for 40 years. And he wrote on this article about the olive tree. And he tells what his experiences have been, you see, and how he knows for a fact that you cannot do in nature what is implied by the Apostle Paul. So that he might not be taken to task for saying something that is not actually so. He says, contrary to nature. See? So Paul is right, you see. But when have you heard a talk on the olive tree when anybody has emphasized the fact that you cannot graft a wild olive into the good olive? See? And so this man, Mr. Thompson, who's writing this, is called The Land and the Book. We know the land of Palestine and the book, the Bible. And so he has references, various scriptures and all of this. So sometimes there may be 3 or 4 or 5 pages just on the one subject. So I take out what he said there, and I'm incorporating this in my notes on the olive tree, to lay particular emphasis on that portion of it, see? And then I take note that what Paul is talking about is that the original branches, which were good olive branches, were broken off. Well, that has reference to the natural fleshly seed of Abraham. The natural fleshly seed of Abraham didn't have the faith that Abraham has. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob they're called the fathers. And then Jehovah says that they would have no blessing at all if it hadn't been for the fathers. That he gave the promise to the fathers. And because, and for the fathers' sake, they were being blessed. So he brings them under the law of Sinai. But Paul says the law was added because of transgression. What was the transgression? Failure to exercise faith. You see, instead of approaching the law and seeing, now this law is beyond us, we can't keep it. No one is living, we're all dying. They had the evidence. But no, even today, the rabbi that writes the article in our local paper here, he quotes Moses, I think it's in the 6th chapter of Deuteronomy, the 25th verse, where Moses says, if we do these things, that is the law, it'll be our righteousness. But instead of saying if, he says by doing these things, it's our righteousness, assuming that they are righteous because they keep the law. Well, Jesus indicated that they weren't keeping it. And so Paul says the law was added because of transgression, not that the law was going to justify the sinner, but the law was going to teach them that they needed a Savior. So when Jesus comes, you see, it says, until the seed would come. Mm-hmm. Well, evidently, it wasn't merely the earthly seed, like the sands of the seashore. It was the spiritual seed that God had reference to, you see. Now, there couldn't have been a spiritual seed before Jesus, because the scriptures say he had to have the preeminence in all things. Consequently, he would have to be the first of the spiritual seed. He was the first one to be resurrected. These others that Elias and others did in Old Testament time, they were merely reawakened. They had to go back into the great prison house of death anyway, you see. Even Lazarus, you see. So, in other words,
Jairus' daughter.
That's right. So, you see, it says he came to his own, and his own received him not. But to as many as received him, he gave the privilege of becoming the sons of God. See, he couldn't make them sons of God. Only God can do that. He can beget of his spirit, you see. But Jesus couldn't do that. He was begotten of God's Holy Spirit himself, and he became a son of God on the spirit level by virtue of his consecration, see. Now, any of those Jews that came to Jesus and believed on his disciples, for example, now, they weren't sons of God, you see. They weren't begotten of God's Holy Spirit. Even though Jesus breathed on them his spirit and sent them out to do things by his power, by his authority, by his spirit. You see, they have to wait. And he says, if I do not go away, the comforter will not come. But if I go away, he'll come and he will bring into remembrance the things that I've told you and reveal more of myself. See? So, in other words, Jesus couldn't make them, but he says, abide together at Jerusalem till you be endowed with power from on high. So they're there together on the day of Pentecost, the sound of a rushing wind, cloven tongues of fire appear on the heads of the apostles, and Peter starts to preach. The fellow that denied his master a few days before now starts to preach, you see. And he's talking about restitution and all of this sort of thing. Well, you see, now you already have the spiritual seed has come. Until the seed should come, that means that the law would end. If Israel recognized its need of the Savior, they could accept him as the Savior. And accepting as the Savior, the law would be ended. But since they didn't accept him, they're still bound by the law. They don't know that their husband is dead. Consequently, since they believe he's alive, they're still bound by the law. Well, so much for that.
Very good. Could you, thank you, Sister Fine, wants us to come eat.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I could read that off. Mm-hmm.
think you could just answer some questions extemporaneously.
I can answer some questions extemporaneously.
Your full name and your birth date and your parents, if you will.
Oh, that's the same as you have on that.
Basically, yes.
Yeah, I see. Well, go ahead, you ask the question.
Well, your full name then, Brother Fry?
Well, my full name is Anton C. Fry. In Europe, that would be Anton, like Anton Dvorak or Anton Rubinstein. But in the States, they call me Anton.
And the C stands for?
The C stands for Clemens. That, of course, was my uncle's name. And when I came along, they didn't know that my brother would be coming along. So they gave me the two names, my father's name and my uncle's name. But Clemens is also the last name of Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens. So I don't know whether that's worth anything. I don't put any stock in that either, but anyway, that just said. Next.
What was your birth date?
The birth date is July the 1st, 1895.
And where were you born?
I was born in what today is known as the Bronx Borough of the city of New York. But in 1895, the Bronx was not a part of the greater city of New York. It did not become a part of the city of New York until 1898. So New York City has no record of my birth anywhere. Whatever records were, they must have been lost. But so since 1898, you see, that was 3 years before we became a part of the city of New York. Evidently, when we became a part, some of the records that belonged to the borough of the Bronx must have been lost. So when it came to establish for the United States government, I had to go to the Methodist Church and asked the pastor to look up the records. And he looked up my baptismal certificate. And that indicated that I was born on July the 1st. And the government has accepted that. So maybe I was born in 1492. You can't prove it.
You mentioned the Methodist Church. Is this what your upbringing was before you came to an Anglican
Yes,
church?
And at that time the Methodist Church was quite different from what the Methodist Church is today. Mm-hmm. In fact, I feel that John Wesley, if he was alive in his grave, he'd probably turn over two or three times if he saw what was going on in the church which he established. He was a sincere man. He endeavored to bring out the spiritual and to do away with a lot of the formality and things that were taking place in the church. He didn't approve of dancing. He didn't approve of smoking. He didn't approve of drinking. Well, I have an idea that probably the Methodists today have no objections to either or any of these. But I still feel that some of those old pastors that we had, gosh, they were gray-haired old men. But they were so earnest, so sincere, they wouldn't think of having a fair or anything like that, even in the basement of the church.
Far cry from the churches of today, isn't it?
Yeah. We never had any novenas.
A what?
We never had any novenas.
I don't know what that is.
That's something in the Roman Catholic Church. I'm a little facetious. I hope that this doesn't go out. But novena is where they have the bones, the relics of one of the saints. And they have an occasion when they're celebrating it in the church. And the people come out, they make a novena or something like that. But as I say, there wasn't anything that approached that Stephen in the old Methodist church. Mm-hmm. For today they have fairs, they have plays. I couldn't see any reason why they couldn't have a little Christmas celebration for the children when they would recite little poems or things which would be on the basis of the Christmas stories. And that was all right, I kind of liked that. And I think the children enjoyed it too. Well, of course, they had Christmas trees. Some people object to Christmas trees. And of course, it's true enough. But I think that originated with Luther. They say he was coming through the woods one winter evening, and as he looked through the branches of the pine trees, he saw the stars glistening, and they looked like little balls of fire. And this gave him the idea. I don't know how true that is, but this is the story that we received. And one of the little boys in Sunday school was asked, he says, is there anything that God can't do? He says, yes. He says, yes. What can he do? Can't please everybody. Well, that was the wisdom of the sages in the mouth of the little one, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it makes no difference what you do. Somebody will be for it, and somebody will be against it. So you do what you think is best, and leave it with the Lord to decide.
Before we go on to your experience in the truth, one more item regarding your earlier life. You've been a shortwave communicator for quite some time. When did you begin that, and has this been continuous service?
Well, I started that in 1909. That was 3 years before the United States government, had any legislation to govern wireless. That's what it was called in those old days, wireless. We didn't call it radio. And I was interested in wireless many, many years before this. But it was in 1909 that there was an article in what was known as the American Boy magazine.
You were 14 years old at this time? You were 14 years old at this time then?
13.
13?
Yeah.
You
see, my birthday was in July.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You see, in other words, I was not quite 14 years old. It was in March 1909. See, I was still 13. I hadn't reached July.
Sure.
So I would have been 14. But at any rate, you see, there was an article in that magazine by a Navy captain. And in it he made mention of the fact that he would like to give us an opportunity to build a 300-mile effective wireless. And he told us how we could make it from parts that we might find around the house, a few little scraps that we could pick up here and there. And so one other fellow and myself, he was about 4 years older than I, but we got busy and we started to work. And the first thing you know, we had radios. But they were called wireless. Of course, they weren't very, very effective. We might work a quarter of a mile. But at least we were going a quarter of a mile. We couldn't send signals around the world, but we might just as well have, because we were just as happy. And when we got through talking to the fellow, we'd go over to visit him. We'd see his rate, and he'd come up and see ours.
You'd figure out ways of improving one another's?
Yes. But there wasn't any such thing as talking by voice. In other words, at the time, he was talking by way of his fingers. He had a key, telegraph. See, that's all we had in those days, was telegraph. So it was nice. And in those days, there was no government to control. You could use any frequency. You could use any call letters.
You use spark gap, couldn't you? Spark gap as well.
Yeah, well, you used a spark gap and a spark coil, you see. But you can't use those today.
No.
No. because the spark has a very broad decrement and it'll be hard to tune it out. And especially with so many people with TVs and radios, you'd get into all of them and you couldn't get out of them.
Yes.
So the United States government tabooed that long years ago. Not even commercially are there any sparks used anymore. But if there are any countries in the world that are primitive enough and haven't joined the other nations, they could transmit on spark, and they could make it very, very hard for all the rest of the world, because you can't tune them out.
Right.
You just have to listen to them. And you know, the interesting thing about it was that in those early years in America, we had what was known as the American Morse code. It had letters with spaces in them. For instance, the letter C was two dots, a space, and a dot. But what was difficult about it was that I was two dots, E was one dot. And if you didn't have the spacing correct, instead of somebody copying did it, did, they would copy did it, did. The eyes. So, of course, in Europe, they developed what was known as the International Morse Code. And every letter was without a space. And consequently, for a while, our American operators were using the American Morse, and the European were using the Continental Morse. So when I got my first license to be a wireless operator, which was in 1913, January the 3rd, 1913, I had to know both codes. And one of these, of course, was an American Morse, and the other was the Continental. And I can still remember when I was taking the test, I had to go over to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. We didn't have any Federal Communications Commission, but it was under the Department of Commerce and Labor. So they didn't have any facilities, so we had to go over to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And there were all of these Navy boys that were having code practice. So we went over there and they gave us a test. Well, of course, they didn't tell us whether the first code was going to be the American or the Continental. So he started to send. And I put down A, F, F, I, V, E, D. Now you see the F in the American Morse is dot, dash, dot. But in the Continental Morse, it's two dots, dash, dot. So I had copied it wrong, but I didn't know whether it was going to be Morse or the International, or Continental Morse, as they call it today. So what happens? Well, I went over it, and I made those FR, so arrived. See, because A-F-F-I-V-E-D didn't mean anything, but arrived did. So he gave me credit for it, because I didn't know whether it's going to be which one. So I got my license, and I didn't go off on the ships until 1914. So I was a wireless operator. But my mother didn't like me being away from home.
You were on a shipboard?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I was on ships, yeah. But I took a small cruise, as you see, so it wouldn't be away too long.
Was this in the military? Were you in the military?
No. This was commercial operator.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, this was commercial operator. I was on the Lexington. That was a passenger vessel. And I was on the New Haven. That was a freighter. On the passenger vessel, you ate with the captain. You were at his table. On the freight vessel, you ate with everybody. All the rank and the file, see. So it was very, very interesting. But Mother So eventually I had to give it up. Yes. I was homesick. There were lots of things at home that I missed. And above all things, they missed me at home.
What year was that? When you were 13 or 14? Or was that in 1913 or 14?
No, that was 14, you see, because my license I got in 13.
Okay, 1914.
But it was 14 and 15, around like that. Mm-hmm. So we had to give it up. Mm-hmm. But the thing was, in those days, things were quite different from what they are today. And we could sign off as we were coming under Brooklyn Bridge. The ship was coming under the bridge, see. And I would sign off to the chief operator, sign off. I could close up the station, put on my hat and coat, and wait till we got and go home, see. Well, that wouldn't do today, see. You'd have to wait until you got to the dock, see. And then you could only sign off after you got there. Well, as I say, in those early days, before there was any legislation, you could take your own initials for your call letters. Well, I wasn't too proud of my initials, ACF. So I thought what I liked, what sounded nice, was MX, and that's the American Morse. And that was da 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 da. It had a rhythm to it, see? Da 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 da. I had a friend who was, he was from England, but he became an American citizen here. His father did. And in those days, if you were under 21 years old, when your father became a citizen, you automatically became a citizen. That doesn't hold today, I understand. But at any rate, so his name was Ronald Hagen. So he used his initials, R-H. Now his initials would sound like this. Now you see, when I called him, it would sound like this. Da 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 da. You got the musical sound. But, so these are some of the things that amused us back in those days. And you didn't have neighbors that complained about you coming in on their TV.
No.
That was the nice thing about it. I mean, and there was no government to say you have no right to be on the frequency. I remember I was using this call MX, and one day I was at the school and I was using their transmitter, and he had about a kilowatt, whereas I only had a 1.5 inch spark coil, so my signal didn't bother anybody. When I got up at the school there with a kilowatt.
On a spark coil?
No, this was on a transformer. With a transformer. But you see, there was a station then, a United Wireless station, in New York. And the call there was NY.
NY.
NY was his call, see. So I got on the air and I signed MX. All of a sudden, the New York operator calls me and he says, "Would you please change your call letters?" He says, "The call letters you have used are being used by the SS Mexico of the Panama Steamship Company or something like that." See. Well, you know, today nobody would tell you to change any call letters. Would you please call them? See? You know, he says, "Make it MF." Well, of course, when I got home, I didn't make it MF because on my own, Ricky might not even hear me. But on the school, we But this is another, just one of those little incidents which occurred, you see.
You've used the radio over the years to proclaim the truth I understand that you helped bring Sister Thomas into the truth by way of
well,
the radio.
Sister Thomas was the first one that I brought into the truth, and the second one was Sister Joyce Anderson in Kingston. They both came in by way of ham radio.
Now, was that in the days of keys for both of them, or was that voice transmission?
Well, you see, as far as Joyce and Thomas were concerned, we were both on the key, telegraph. There was no voice transmission as yet, you see. It was all on the key. So Sister Thomas had to know the Morse code, and Joyce, she still knows the Morse code. I still talk her in the Morse code. She doesn't want to talk the voice. She doesn't like everybody else to know her business. So few, if anybody knows the code, so they can't understand what she's telling me.
So,
yes, they want to
know.
Well, Sister Thomas, that was way back in 1927.
Wait, first of all, when did you come into a knowledge of the truth? You mentioned some of this on the way here in the car, that you received your first Bible dictionary from Sister Hirsch at the Bible House. Was that your first contact with the truth? Or?
No.
Okay, you had contact previously.
We were already in the truth at that time, you see.
What year did you first hear of it? Not consecrated, but when did you first come to a knowledge that there was such a thing as the Bible Students Movement and the pastor's works?
What year?
She just stepped on. Well, were you married already at the time?
Oh, yes. We were married all right.
Well,
let me see. No,
you
that was
been
1919.
Married.
Okay. Yes. Of 19. This was
when you were married, yes.
Now, what I wanted to ask her was when my father died.
She's coming in now.
No, she's outside.
Oh, she's right here. Come in.
Do you remember when my father died that year? That was.
It was soon after we went together.
Well, I'll tell you something. Well, I don't know whether I could tell you the date on that or not. But I'll tell you something. That when I first heard of Pastor Russell, his picture was on everything. Mm-hmm. Everywhere you went. The newspaper columns. And I was teaching a Sunday school class.
You were teaching a Sunday school class in the Methodist Church?
That's right. Mm-hmm. I had been librarian there too. I objected to some of the books that they had in the library too. But at any rate,
I'm just checking everything. Go ahead.
It is?
Yeah. I look away occasionally to see if things are all working all right. You just keep going on. Ignore me if you can. Just.
Well, as I look at the picture there, and there's something in front of my face, I think that's the reflection of that light.
Oh, I think it's the light up in your living room there. That's.
Do you know how to put it out?
I can turn the light out or I can turn the TV set off a little bit.
No, you can turn it out there from the outside.
Okay.
You mean that's
yeah,
been.
Yeah, I'll do it.
I'll get it.
Yeah, you see, now that's better. But I think probably on all of your pictures now, you've probably got that.
No. That's just what you saw on the TV screen.
That will not be there?
That won't be on the picture. No.
Oh, well,
this is all that comes, all that matters.
That makes me remember. Nice that we would be on the. Do you want a new tablet? You would have sat here. You want a tablet?
Well, I don't think I'm going to take this license.
Okay.
I'm going to leave that for tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyhow, you were saying that you came to the truth. You saw Brother Russell's picture on everything. And
yeah, when I first became acquainted with him and learned something of him, I taught my scholars in the Sunday school that he was one of the antichrists of the last days. There's been a big change.
I think so.
And
what brought that
him.
Change about? No, it wasn't in him.
And the first time I heard him, we went down. Sis and I, we used to visit all of the churches in New York.
Now, you weren't married yet at this time, right?
No, we visited the various churches.
This was in the evening.
Sunday evenings, through New York. And so we visited the Baptist, the Presbyterian, the Episcopal, and the church. If they had an interesting subject, we'd go in to see. So I heard Haldeman, that's the one that Brother Russell had so much trouble with.
Oh, yes, yes.
I never saw a man that could say more in one breath than that man.
Haldeman.
He was an old man, but he could speak so fast. And he had about a page and a half in there. In one breath.
In one breath.
And he said, see, this is when World War I was on. Mm-hmm. And he says, if the Kaiser isn't Antichrist, he's a shadow of the Antichrist. So we went to these various churches and listened to what they had to say. And then, so one day we went down to listen to Pastor Russell. Well, he came out from out of the wings then and put his hand up like that. I looked at that hand, it looked to me like a foot. When he opened his mouth, it sounded like a growl. But you know, he had the loveliest hand that ever a man had. And his voice was the sweetest of any man that I've ever known. The change wasn't in him. I always think of the girl. Her sweetheart was leaving one night, and she says, sweetheart, you know I have a book in my library that's written by a man who has the same name that you have and the same initials. She says, isn't that singular? He says, no, I don't think so. She says, pray, why not? I wrote the book. Before that, she said, not to him, but she said it was the driest thing that she'd ever read. Didn't see how a man could sit down and write any garbage like that. But when he went home that night, she dug out the book, sat up all night. She says, that's the sweetest story I ever read. She got to know the author. See? And when I got to know Brother Russell, it made a world of difference. Who is there today that is as anxious to defend him against the wiles of the adversary of today? I don't find anyone around here that wants to defend him. I mean, actually, if they'll give up and say, well, he was guessing at this. Mm. He made a mistake here and all of this. And half the time they don't know what they're talking about, see? So at any rate, of course, there was a change that came into my heart. I can't tell you just when. Sis and I, we were both immersed in the creation temple.
This was before Brother Russell died.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes. Well, I got to see Brother Russell when Sister Grace Hollister brought me over and introduced me. That was the same day that we went to that prayer meeting where Judge Rutherford led the service.
And Sister Hollister had mentioned that she was crying.
Oh, she didn't mention. She didn't say. But she cried all the way through the service. And I found out later on that he was the cause of it. She knew what he was.
And this was in like 1915?
Oh, I don't know what year that was.
Before Brother Russell died?
Well, it was before he died. So it was before October 16th, you see. And when he died in 1916, I didn't want to believe it. And we were waiting for more news and more news and more news, and finally it came. Then after a while, the first thing that the judge put out was the seventh volume. Mm-hmm. and it was put out as the penny.
Right, the penny of the parables.
But it had a lot of what Brother Russell had said in it. Well, there's a lot that is guesswork. Mm-hmm. And they've rejected it themselves. They don't back it up today, you see.
Brother W.A. Baker told a story once of he had a conversation with Pastor Russell back in the later years of Brother Russell's career. And he said that he had asked Brother Russell, will there be a seventh volume? This is in private conversation, not in a congregation question meeting. And Brother Russell said, well, when I first started out, I thought there would be three, because three was a complete number in itself. And then as I progressed along, I saw everything couldn't be held in just three volumes, so we thought the number would be seven. But there was no reason to think there had to be a seventh volume. And also that he felt that when he came to a clear enough knowledge of Revelation, he would write on Revelation. But until then, he wasn't going to even put down partial thoughts, because then he felt the brethren would fill in the holes.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's what's been going on ever since, hasn't it?
Well, you see, when he was on his last trip, and Brother Sturgeon was his secretary,
mm-hmm.
they were talking about this matter, and Brother Sturgeon asked Brother Russell, who's going to write the seventh volume? Mm-hmm. And I believe his answer was somebody else could do it.
Mm-hmm.
But
did you know Brother Sturgeon years later? Did you ever have a conversation with him about that?
No, not years later, but while Brother Russell was still alive,
mm-hmm.
he used to be on the platform there, and he gave some of the best talks. You see, he was a minister to begin with, and he knew how to speak, he knew how to present these matters. And he had a shock of white silver hair, you know, and he'd push it back from the
same. Keep going. Yeah. Keep going. I just wanted to grab some things here from the other room. Did a shock of white hair, he push it back, and what? What did you say? He had a shock of white hair?
He had a shock of that silver white hair, you know, come down all his forehead, and he just put his hands through there, and he had a pointer in his hand, he'd point to the map, you know. I loved the man, yes. And he was all right when he was Brother Russell's secretary. But it was shortly after that he got mixed up with a fellow by the name of Olson out in the mountain states there. And that fellow believed in some weird things. And he went along with them. And just really to think that it was so soon after Brother Rustin died.
Yeah. I'm trying to find a... Here they are. I believe you have the same group of pictures in the convention reports. Maybe you could go through these various brethren's pictures and tell me a little something about any of them if you happen to know them. There's on the other side also. And of course, you know something about Brother Russell and his use of the car.